From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with Megan Angelo, author of Followers, published by Graydon House. Megan Angelo has written about television, film, women, and pop culture, and motherhood for publications including the New York Times, where she helped launch city comedy coverage, Glamour, where she was a contributing editor and wrote a column on women and television, Elle, The Wall Street Journal, Marie Claire, and Slate. She's a native of Quakertown, Pennsylvania, and a graduate of Villanova University. She currently lives in Pennsylvania with her family. Followers is her first novel. It's the story of two ambitious friends and the dark choices they make to become internet famous. Orla Cadden is a budding novelist stuck in a dead-end job, writing clickbait about movie star hookups and influencer yoga moves. Then Orla meets Floss, a striving wannabe A-lister, who comes up with a plan for launching them both into the high-profile lives they dream about. So what if Orla and Floss's methods are a little shady, and sometimes people get hurt? Their legions of followers can't be wrong. 35 years later, in a closed California village where government-appointed celebrities live every moment of the day on camera, a woman named Marlo discovers a shattering secret about her past. Despite her massive popularity, 12 million loyal followers, Marlo dreams of fleeing the corporate sponsors who would do anything to keep her on screen. When she learns that her whole family history is based on a lie, Marlo finally summons the courage to run in search of the truth, no matter the risks. Followers traces the paths of Orla, Floss, and Marlo as they wind through time toward each other and toward a cataclysmic event that sends America into lasting upheaval. At turns wry and tender, bleak and hopeful, this darkly funny story reminds us that even if we obsess over famous people we'll never meet, what we really crave is genuine human connection. When I spoke with Megan Angelo, I first asked how Followers began for her. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
I had been looking for a new idea, and I had a one-year-old at the time. Mm-hmm. I was doing some journaling about him, writing in my journal, and thinking like, oh, someday this little baby will grow up and read this and see what a card his mother was and all of this stuff. And I realized that I write in cursive, and so maybe he won't be able to read it, or if he's able to make it out, probably definitely not my grandchildren or anything like that. And it was just kind of this interesting moment for me, because I'm not really someone who's drawn to sci-fi or dystopia or futuristic kind of pop culture. Mm-hmm. But I thought, well, it would be neat to write something that is set in the future partially, but that's sort of the relationship between the future and the present. And that's sort of the tone, where it's more things about, you would say to your grandchildren, well, this is how we used to do it, rather than, you know, flying cars and robots and right. Stuff like that.
Yeah. And actually that really works well as far as what the changes are between your two time periods, because you've got paper as like an antiquated feature of life. And obviously mm-hmm. the fact that nobody can read script anymore. Is that true though? Like, do people, like, I got to ask my kids if they read script.
Well, it's actually borne out a little bit, because of course I researched it in the process, but since that time, the baby I was referencing has gone to kindergarten, and I've become a little more familiar with the public school curriculum, and no, he is not going to be learning cursive.
Right.
I think they still do it in the Catholic school, mm-hmm. but, so I think my kids will pick it up, because they'll have to, in the way that you sort of adapt to things your parents do that you don't do. But I think, like, certainly if you don't have neat penmanship, if you sort of have your own style of things, then I would wager that a young kid in school right now is not going to be able to make that out.
Yeah,
Wow, that's really interesting. Now, your two time periods, as I said, you have two time periods going. One is the year 2015, which eventually turns to 2016, and then one is the year 2051. How did you choose those 2 years?
Well, I was writing the book in 2016. Okay. I sort of began in earnest in November of 2016, the first draft. And so 2015 felt very recent at the time. But as I got closer to publication, you know, there was some talk of like, well, 2015, it's sort of like the near past. Could we just say it's now? But I said no, because I think that technology and social media have evolved so quickly that you almost couldn't have the same conceits even 3 years later. Right. Like, well, Floss looks to Orla, who works at sort of a legitimate media outlet, to help her get famous. But just a few years later, I don't think these people who are so good at getting big on Instagram need traditional media outlets at all. So that was sort of how I pinned down that end of the storyline. And then as for 2051, I actually used the cursive again as a little bit of a rubric there. I wanted to see, you know, reasonably how old would someone be if they could not read cursive and maybe had enough distance that they wouldn't have picked it up. So I kept using these little human measures to try and pin down the big world.
Uh-huh. I was wondering how hard it was for you to jump back and forth between what was a kind of relatable time period and then a dystopian future that you were inventing, even if it wasn't flying cars.
It was difficult. I mean, I did write the book sort of the way you see it. I mean, obviously, all the cliffhangers weren't as nice and neat in the first draft, but I did go back and forth just to kind of keep myself interested, frankly. But I struggled with the future. There were early drafts of this book that I fondly refer to as the 11th grader on acid drafts, because I just, you know, it just takes a while to get a handle on the future. And I wrote lots of stuff that had, in the end, nothing to do with the story I was telling. You know, the journalist in me was like, well, let's talk about what the climate's like in depth, and let's talk about what famine is like in depth. But really, that had nothing to do with Marlowe's journey. So I probably wrote a good 75 to 100 pages of the book that ended up being cut. But I guess maybe I needed to do it just to sort of figure out what neighborhood of the future I was going to live in and how I was going to just stick there.
Now, as you're working, I noticed right from the start, you allude to a backstory that readers don't yet know about. And I always think that's really an interesting thing to do. I think it kind of builds curiosity, which is great. But I wonder how hard it is to control. So like when you start the book and there are allusions to something called the spill, but we're not going to learn what that is for a long time. So how hard is that as the author to control?
The challenge for me was really knowing how much to tease it.
Yeah.
And it was interesting because I didn't want to lean on it too hard. I always felt like I was teasing too many times, like testing the reader's patience a little bit. But it was interesting because as the book went through the publication process, both my agent and my editor were sort of like, no, we need to tease a little more. And I tend to trust the structural instincts of, you know, people like that.
Yeah.
But I did find it challenging because you worry, like, every single time you do that, you're raising the stakes as to how well you're going to deliver.
Uh-huh.
And, I mean, I was ultimately really satisfied with how the spill turns out at the end of the book. But yeah, I mean, I certainly, just to be totally frank, I get dinged in reviews sometimes, reader reviews. If people don't like that ending, then they don't like it even more because they've been waiting and waiting and being teased about it. But one thing I did to try and sort of keep my nerves at bay with all of that was I actually did hold off on writing that entire segment of the book until I had everything else in order. I felt like, okay, Megan, if the reader's going to have to wait this long, then you do too.
Oh, that's smart. And then you probably had the same anticipation around it before you got to it.
Yes, I did. It was genuinely like so much fun to sit down and write that, which is now I said that and I'm like, that's sort of a sick thing to say considering the subject material. But I think it was sort of that satisfaction of like, okay, you've earned it. Let's let loose now.
Right. And also I don't like to give away endings, but you've got a lot happening at the end of the book. And so there's quite a lot coming together. So that must have been quite the challenge to bring it all home.
It was. Yeah. I actually just listened to, there was a podcast that did a book club of the book the other day, and they did a very in-depth summary up top. And I just sat there and thought, oh my God, I can't believe I put this much stuff into this book. but yeah, it was, you know, you want to tie things up with a bow, of course, but there's some things about the ending that feel a little bit convenient even to me now, but there's also reasons that I wanted things to be a little convenient for some of these characters, especially Marlo, who has had her life so tightly managed over the course of her 35 years that I felt like she deserved a little serendipity, honestly.
Yeah, yeah. Now, a lot of the book focuses, I mean, obviously, like the title says, that the followers are a very important component of life in this society, and actually both societies, 2015 and 2051. But fame is a huge theme in this book. I actually had to laugh. At one point, you mentioned somebody is a towel maintenance associate, and it's like everybody wants to be special. And that was the person who's handing towels out, I think, at the pool. So
yes,
let's see. So talk a little bit about the aspect of this book that's got to do with fame and needing to be seen.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Well, I had been working in celebrity entertainment journalism for many years before I wrote the book and had sort of seen some of the strange stuff that goes on behind the scenes that, you know, people at home don't get to see. I mean, when you see celebrities walk down a red carpet, you don't see that all the reporters are squashed like cattle and it's like a really frantic scene. And when you look at a beautiful fashion spread in a magazine, you don't see that, frankly, sometimes the way the photo shoot goes just looks kind of stupid. Like, I don't want to be disrespectful, but I mean, when you look at people pose in the manner that makes for a flattering picture and you watch that in person, it's like out of body because it just looks insane. So what I really wanted to do is to make sure that people could always see both sides of the coin in the book and to understand that someone like Floss, who has, as you're saying, that drive to be looked at, is willing to do all the sort of crazy stuff that you might feel like an idiot for in the moment, but that, you know, pays off.
I always think about that with actors, too. You know, you watch these incredibly dramatic scenes on the big screen and you're like so impressed. But then you think about what it must be like to be on set with like 100 people standing around and cameras close up in your face and you're trying to deliver this dramatic. I mean, I think that must be really hard.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, whatever you're doing, even if you're delivering an Oscar-worthy performance, there's a tent of snacks just like 20 feet away. Like, you know what I mean? So it's a credit to actors because when we watch the movie, we never think there are snacks 20 feet away. But that's the reality. That's just sort of a funny scene.
That's so funny. Let's see. Do you mind if I just read a little bit of an early part of the book and then we can talk about
it? No, I would love that. That's a nice change from listening to my own voice.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Let's see. This is from Orla's point of view. When she and her colleagues sat in the conference room watching Ingrid run her laser pointer over a screen filled with top performing headlines, you won't believe what this megastar looks like without her extensions. Orla would think about how every one of their minds was somewhere else, lusting over their next moves, reminding themselves they were better, better than this job and better than the girl in the next seat doing it too. That last part was important. Orla believed it fiercely. She would be gone someday, on to greater things, and the next girl down would still be in her chair. She better still be in her chair. Someone had to stay to be who Orla was before. That was like such a great thing to include early on, because it lets us know that Orla has this ambition. And it's very universal, I think, this feeling of needing to be better than in order to be good enough. But it's so sad.
Yeah, I think so too. And, you know, what I wanted to reveal about Orla, who goes through some rough stuff in this book as a result of her collaboration with Floss, was that she's not really innocent or super virtuous or super humble either. I mean, she thinks that, you know, the influencer brand of fame is tawdry, but is it really any better than like wanting to write a book so that you can have all of sort of the fancy stuff that goes with it?
Right. Let's see. Early on, there's this conversation between Orla and Floss. Now, this is this great moment in the book where Orla and Floss are actually roommates, but they have so little contact with each other that their interactions sort of start coincidentally outside of their apartment, which is really funny. But once Floss realizes who Orla is, and Orla is somebody who works basically in PR and is, you know, a publicist helping to hype online personalities, and there's this moment where Floss sort of recounts all of Orla's social media efforts on behalf of someone named Sage. And I felt like that was like this really smart way of helping readers follow the culture. Even media savvy readers need to understand what the world of the book is. So I don't know if you remember writing that scene, but was that what you had in mind, that it would sort of help us figure out what needed to be done for Floss to get attention?
Yeah, I mean, that scene is probably my favorite scene in the whole book, when two girls are on the roof. Yeah, I love it because I think it does accomplish a lot for the reader, but it also just shows their personalities so clearly.
Right.
But the Sage stuff really came from, yes, me wanting to say, this is how it's done, because this book doesn't happen if Orla is just someone with sort of a job she's not happy in who wants to be a famous writer. You know, we've seen that story a million times. What I wanted the reader to understand was that, you know, as you mindlessly scroll through Apple News headlines on your phone every day, it feels random and it feels very impersonal, but there's a person behind every one of those stories, and they're probably never going to be famous for what they're doing, but they do wield a certain amount of power, because it used to be, you know, when I was growing up, all I wanted in the world was to write for Vanity Fair or to write for the New York Times. But I've had stories in the New York Times, and you know what? I don't think as many people read those stories on paper as people read, you know, a blog post from Vox.com that happens to make it to the top of your Apple News every day.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
I do, yeah.
So it's sort of this, Orla sits at this crossroads where the glory is absolutely the least it's ever been in the history of journalism, but the power in some ways is at its height.
And it's changing so fast. And
yeah.
I think you capture that well in the book. Another thing I loved was just like little tips about how to be Orla in her job. Like, there was this mention of 9 insane facts about Sage Sterling. And then you write, never 10 facts. Readers hated the number 10. It was too perfect, too choreographed, suspect. Which is so crazy.
That's true.
Yeah.
That's a real rule. That was always a rule. And also to never put green on a magazine cover was always a rule. But I think that has gone away. I've seen Billie Eilish with her gorgeous green hair and green nails on the covers of Elle and Vogue in the past 6 months. So
also,
things are changing.
Oprah's done green on her covers. I'm sure she has.
She loves like an emerald off the shoulder.
Right.
Get for sure she has done green. But then, I mean, that's Oprah. She can do anything.
She can do anything. So from your work, it sounds like you already knew a lot about this world. Did you have to do a lot of research as you were writing, for example, the social media stuff and all of the kind of publicity efforts?
I really did not have to research any of that. I mean, just my inbox alone is rife with publicist characters. And don't get me wrong, I love publicists. And the one I have to brag and say Kathleen Carter is the best in the business. Yeah. But there is, again, it's this stuff that nobody sees that I think is really, really interesting. Yeah. Where, you know, publicists often are people who really are writers and who have sort of come to inhabit like the flip side of writing in a way. So yeah, not a lot of research. All of this stuff has been accumulating in my brain for over a decade now.
And then, so not to tie this to publicists, and they work hard and they are good at what they do, but did you ever find it depressing as you were writing? I mean, some of the aspects of this culture that are negative, was that hard to be writing about?
You know, that's a really good question. And I don't think I did, but only because I'm used to it. I mean, yeah. If I was going to feel depression over that stuff, I think when I felt it was, you know, when I was 22 and a bright-eyed assistant at Condé Nast who didn't understand how things worked and who, in short order, was screamed at by many, many publicists who didn't like, you know, this story or that story. Or I remember, I won't mention her name, but there's a publicist who was always sort of the right-hand woman for Roger Ailes at Fox News, the late Roger Ailes. And I was just doing an infographic on him one time. I mean, no original interview, no nothing. I'm like 23. But she called and just intimidated the heck out of me. And so, you know, I have had some time to build up a thick skin to the more negative aspects of all this stuff.
Yeah. I loved Orla's description of celebrity. She calls a celebrity a person exaggerated. I thought that was great. I don't know.
Thank you.
I don't know that I have a question, but I thought that was great. The other thing I really liked was that Orla and Floss, so you've got a few main characters. You've got Marlo in a kind of futuristic time period, and Floss is in that time period too. And then you've got Orla and Floss in an earlier time period. But Orla and Floss, neither of them is perfect, and neither of them is completely evil. And I really love how real they are. And I felt like you did a really good job of creating actual people that aren't heroes that we can relate to as narrators. Well, Orla's a narrator, more or less. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, that was a big challenge of the book, too, because I think the same thing that made me a little numb to the negative aspects of the celebrity industrial complex made me maybe, like, I could swallow some of the things I knew these girls were going to do more easily than the average person.
Right.
So I really had to put on like those average person glasses and make sure that I was making them just at least a little bit redeemable, which once listeners have read the book will understand that it's not so easy because they do some really, really dark things. But I just really always brought it back to the hypnotic quality of fame. And the fact that I think most of us, if we're not completely introverted, can relate to the idea of, well, you know, maybe I would stretch a little bit to have this amount of attention or glory or positive, you know, feedback from the world. Right. And so I really, you know, the other key was that it had to go little by little by little. And I think that's how it goes with fame too. You think, oh, you know, I would never be someone who like holds up a smoothie on my Instagram and writes hashtag ad, but maybe I'll do this just this once. And then it's sort of a slippery slope.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I love that it's even kind of infused in the personal lives of these characters, you know, like the enmity between the Nana and the other grandmother and like who gets to be top, you know, granny in that situation. And, you know, we're all so desperate to be loved and approved of. And I think you did a really good job, like with the Towel Maintenance Associate, you did a really good job of just showing how in each of our little universes we want to be noticed.
Yeah, absolutely. It's so funny. The town maintenance associate has come up about 300 times more than I expected it to. But I love that that details like that are standing out. And I think you're right. I think that's why something like that resonates, because we all want our due, no matter what we're up to.
Yeah, yeah. Now, let's talk a little bit about your character names. And you've got great character names. Floss, for example, is a wonderful name. And then there's Orla and Marlo, which, you know, interestingly, there's some overlap there in the way that those names come across, although it's not super obvious because O starts with a vowel and M starts with an M. But if you look at it, there's some overlap. So I don't know. Talk about maybe how you come up with your character names.
Yeah, so that's, first of all, that's very savvy that you recognize that. There's definitely a connection between Orla and Marlo's names. And it's funny that you mention it, too, because some people have asked me, like friends of mine reading the book, have been like, oh, the names are so pretty. Like, how did you choose these names? And that's when they're on page 40.
Yeah.
And then when they're on page 320 or whatever, they're like, oh, now I get it about the name. So, but, you know, just in terms of how I chose the names in general, I have three kids and two are boys, one is a girl. That left me with roughly 1,200 girl baby names that I wanted to use that I didn't get to use. And I love names, especially female names. And I always rename my characters again and again and again, except in this book. For some reason in this book, these girls were always named this. And Floss was probably my favorite one to come up with, because I was like, okay, I really want it to be a name that has the Madonna quality, that like you wouldn't know another one. You don't necessarily need her last name. And it took me a long time to come up with something that just sounded cool. But there's sort of little winks to both of my grandmothers in this book. Orla's last name is Cadden, and that was my grandmother's, one of my grandmother's maiden names. My other grandmother had an identical twin named Florence, and she always went by Flossie. So that's how I sort of was like, oh, Flossie, you know, that's kind of has like a rich, glamorous sound, but Floss is sort of the decisive, iconic version of that.
Yeah. Okay. That's great. Now, we've talked a little bit about how Orla helps Floss become known. But then also in your other time period, Marlo is very, very well known. And this is a completely different situation. She actually lives in a town that's all about being known. It's all about famous people. And she basically is on camera all her life, pretty much, except like when she goes into the ladies' room. But I love this moment. So there's this one moment where she's kind of going off script, and you write, an eerie jangle ran through Marlo. She had never had a secret from the network before. She had never really had a secret, period. She couldn't find a place in her mind to put it. It wasn't a comfortable fit. I loved that paragraph. I loved that feeling of like not having enough independence that it's even a comfortable fit to have a moment by yourself. I feel like that was probably a big part of what you wanted to get across in Marlo's life.
It was, yeah. And thank you about that, because that's another passage I really liked writing.
Yeah.
You know, that really, so again, coming back to the idea that I always wanted to take the future and really dig into what it would feel like culturally and personally, I have handed Marlo sort of this crazy Black Mirror technology-based world where, like you're saying, not only is she on camera all the time, but she also wears the device, which anyone in America who's communicating in 2051 wears this device where essentially instead of talking to Siri, you just think things in a forceful way and the device responds in your head. There's no external sound or screen. So once I had sort of thrown all of that onto this character, I had to deal with the human elements of it. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I mean, someone who is always on camera and who, you know, can't even really think hard about something without risking her device picking up on it as a command, would not be someone with a lot of secrets. And this is kind of the moment that Marlo starts to see that there might be a different way to live.
And the device itself is also really an interesting thing to have come up with. And I wondered, like, you didn't have any inkling. I think I saw this on your Twitter feed recently. I'm trying to think where I saw this, but I feel like I saw that you mentioned that this is something you came up with thinking like, oh, this is maybe down the road going to happen. And then you just recently saw that Elon Musk is talking about this kind of technology, or is that somebody else?
Yes. No, you're exactly right. And I think the book was already sold and on its way when I saw that about Elon Musk. And I was like, oh, this is so great, because certainly not to say that I'm ahead of him on the curve or anything, but with this book, the risk was always how many things will people go on the ride for, and how many things will people be like, okay, that could never happen. Stop being annoying. So, you know, to be able to point to Neuralink, which is the name of his incubator, I'm pretty sure, was a great comfort.
Well, your book is arriving at a very, I think, appropriate time. I'm actually a little shocked that this book is not crowded out by other similar things right now in the market. Do you feel that way too?
I do. I mean, the timing is perfect, but it's sort of not what I expected the world would look like when I thought this book would come out.
Right.
I mean, I think I said earlier that I really started the first draft in earnest in November 2016, which I think is a memorable month for everyone, right, even if they didn't start a book that month. And as I outlined the book, you know, so that means I was outlining basically in September and October, and I'm watching the news and I'm thinking, like everyone else in America, that one thing is about to happen, and obviously something very different happened. So the ideas I was coming up with felt to me like a sort of a dark alternate reality. There's stuff towards the end of the book that's kind of, you know, geopolitical that I thought, oh my God, if I get away with this, it will be a miracle. But by the time the book hit shelves, the news had kind of caught up with a lot of this stuff. It's really weird. I mean, I thought it was going to feel like such a reach, but some people see the book as, you know, satire on every page. And I certainly did not think I was satirizing some parts. Some parts were, I thought, really, really, really big inventions.
Right.
And not so much after the last few years.
Yeah, I interviewed Dave Eggers, has a book that's a satire about Trump. And as I was interviewing him, we talked about the fact that it's hard to satirize Trump. I mean,
it's very hard to satirize Trump. Yeah. And I, you know, people who have finished the book will see sort of how I handle him. But suffice to say, I didn't want him to be a big part of the book. Mm-hmm. He just kind of overwhelms every room, every story.
Yeah.
Every Twitter timeline he comes into, and he's almost too consistent to be an interesting character.
let's see. I want to ask you what you've read lately that you might recommend to listeners.
Absolutely. So right now I'm reading a book that came out last year called Very Nice by Marcy Dermansky.
Mm-hmm.
It's a beautiful book. It's just a character-driven story about like a professor and sort of the way he gets in between a mother and daughter. And I absolutely love her writing. I adored Such a Fun Age by Kylie Reed, which does not need any promotion from me. It's doing so fabulously, but it's always really satisfying to see a book that is great get so much attention.
Right.
So I loved that book. What else have I been reading? There's been a lot of wonderful books in the past year, but I loved Long Bright River by Liz Moore. I loved Ask Again, Yes by Mary Beth Keane.
Oh, yeah.
Nothing to See Here by Kevin Wilson. And I just got my hands on a copy of Q. I don't know if you've heard of this book. This is not out yet, but it is Christina Dolcher's follow-up to Vox.
Yeah.
Which I love and obviously was very inspired by. So I'm really looking forward to reading that one.
Okay, cool. What about you? What are you writing next?
So I am working on a second book right now. It's set in 1999, sort of in the month leading up to Y2K.
Uh-huh.
And it's a coming of age story that really revolves kind of around AOL Instant Messenger and sort of a lot of 1.0 stuff when it came to technology. The idea is sort of that you could still disappear then because the internet was kind of just something in your living room. You know, you didn't carry it around with you and all your data wasn't online, but essentially, two best friends who are now in their 30s all of a sudden encounter this girl one day who they were long convinced was, someone fake that their friend had made up on AOL Instant Messenger. So it's sort of a found person's tale rather than a missing person's tale. But yeah, that's been really fun. I mean, I was 15 when I started to use Instant Messenger, and so it's very nostalgic for me. And then I'm working on some TV and film projects, which is what I was doing prior to Followers. So it's been nice to kind of dive back in, develop some script ideas, and try to get them out there.
Oh, that's great. Do you do that in conjunction with anybody else, or is this just you?
No, just me. When I got started, I've written a bunch of projects with my husband, actually, who has a day job in technology, but has always been a writer as well.
Uh-huh.
But now I just kind of write on my own. So yeah, it's fun though. After writing a novel, it feels nice to go back to scripts where, you know, now and again, you can be like, oh, that's for the production designer to figure out.
That's funny. Now, I'm wondering, you know, your background in journalism and also just sort of modern culture makes me think you're probably quite social media savvy. And I'm wondering how much of the marketing of the book are you taking on, and just how much of it is social media and how much of it is what your publicist is doing and just that part of the journey.
Well, I'm going to be brutally honest with you.
Yeah.
I can do it. I can do the social media when called upon to do it. And obviously, yes, when you're promoting a book, you have to do it a lot. But it kind of all really ramped up, like, again, right as I had my kids. So I feel like I'm at this, like, double disadvantage where, first of all, I am just sort of behind technologically. And second of all, I have nothing clever to say because I'm just pouring juice for roughly 95% of the day. So it's been a little bit of a struggle, but I have tried to, you know, do a lot more of it and promote the book a lot on social media. If it was just about me, I wouldn't do anything, but I'm like, well, there's a whole team of people, as everyone knows, behind every book that comes out. So I'm trying to really put some effort into it. But again, and then there's also the fact that it's like, because of the subject matter of the book, it's completely hypocritical. I mean, I did a Q&A from Facebook Live a couple of weeks ago, and I was like, yeah, okay, this is the height of hypocrisy. I'm promoting my book about the evils of social media from the place where it all began.
Well, I think it's actually a book about having a choice about whether or not you involve yourself in this life. And you're obviously talking about having to make choices also.
I think you're right. And actually, I thank you for that clarification, because I do worry that in a lot of the interviews I've done about the book, people expect me to really be a pearl clutcher, a hand wringer about social media. And I don't actually feel that way. I mean, even the thing that sort of inspired this entire book, where I was feeling a little sad about the progress that has happened that has made it so that my son won't know how to read cursive.
Mm-hmm.
I've even come around on that, honestly. I mean, now I'm watching my son learning to read, period, and realizing that, you know, maybe I knew cursive, but he's learning to read English and Spanish at the same time at the age of 5. He's learning to use technology in ways that are really beneficial. And so I think that, yes, it's not a story about the evils of social media. It's really kind of a mirror that anyone can hold up to their ambivalences about social media.
Right. You know, it's funny. I have two thoughts about the cursive thing. One is it was originally designed to go faster. I mean, I think cursive, mm-hmm. like the letters all lead into each other. And so it's about going faster, yep. which is what our whole world is about too. And it'll also become, you know, retro and cool at some point. And people will want to know.
You are spot on with both of those things. I love that. It will definitely, by the time my grandkids come around, it will be all about cursive.
Exactly.
And yeah, you're right. Cursive was technology. So
really
on
is.
And on the wheel spins.
Now, I want to know, you were talking about a whole team of people behind every book, and that reminded me that I want to ask you about your publishing journey and about Graydon House. Now, you said you wrote your first draft, like, right around the time of the election in 11 of 16. So that seems mm-hmm. like a pretty fast track. So how soon did you have a publisher?
I sold the book in, I believe, April 2018.
Okay.
So yeah, looking back, it was fast, although it didn't feel fast when I was in it. But you know, the bulk of the revision, I did a lot of revising with my agent and her associate at Jankel and Nesbitt, Stephanie Lieberman and Molly Steinblatt. Uh-huh. And they, you know, they had to sit through all those 11th grader on acid drafts, and they really helped me shape the book into what it was. But you know, when it finally did go out, then it was a relatively fast process. And, my editor at Graydon House, Brittany Lavery, saw what I was trying to do immediately, like really saw the potential. So after a lot of things feeling very, very hard, that part felt easy, which was nice.
Now, you have a background in journalism. So how did that help you as you were writing the book? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, it definitely helped me. I do think I write kind of fast. I've been told that I write fast. I'm very deadline oriented, but more so than that, momentum oriented.
Okay.
Like once I get started, then I'm really going. And, you know, I mean, when I was working, I've had jobs where I had to produce 6 to 8 blog posts a day.
Wow.
So yeah, it's not really, it doesn't feel insane to me to generate a couple thousand words a day, even if they're not great. So I do think it helped with that, but it hindered me too, because there were a lot of times writing this book that I found myself reporting instead of, you know, going deep into the characters' heads. And then I would go back and say, okay, I know you're excited and you want to get this detail out there, but it can't be from your perspective. Like, what does Orla think of it? Or how would Floss see it?
Right.
So it was kind of a double-edged sword.
Okay, great. Now, you write fast, but you're writing novels, or you were. So do you mm-hmm. find that it was slow in the middle? Did you get into the sort of like murky middle people talk about?
Yeah, the middle is the absolute worst. I have nothing new to contribute in defense of the middle. The middle, I don't know who invented the middle, but it was a terrible idea.
Like, when you don't know what's going to happen next, what do you do? Or do you know what's going to happen?
I am usually someone whose problem is too many ideas, too much stuff. And that almost sounds like a humble brag, but it's really not, because I think specifically with followers, what it indicated in me was a lack of confidence at times. I mean, this was my first book. I don't have an MFA. I didn't enter into this project with a great deal of confidence that I could finish it.
Uh-huh.
So yes, I felt that deeply in the middle, but usually for me, figuring out what to do next was an exercise in saying, you don't need to decorate this solid plot point with like 60 other spangly things. Like, this is the plot point. Invest in it and believe in it and keep the story moving.
One thing that occurred to me as I read Followers is how much writers want to be read. We want our work to be celebrated, and so to that extent, we want to be seen and noticed. So I wonder if you have advice for writers who might be listening about the subjects of writing and publication of fame and being followed, you know, as far as, you know, what you've learned in writing this book.
Mm-hmm. Well, I can tell you that if I'm being really honest, when I was in my 20s, I shared some of Orla's feelings that, you know, part of the reason I wanted to be a quote unquote real writer was to have people look at me that way.
Right.
But now, kind of 15 years later, I'm doing what I always hoped I would do. And I'm very relieved to find out that that's not the best part at all. You know, it's really not like every stage of trying to get to this point, I was just so buried in trying to get to the next thing. And I do think I always thought, well, if I ever have a book, have a movie made, you know, create a TV series, it will be so wonderful to have people follow me on Instagram and I'll be invited to events and, you know, I'll have something to attach myself to that looks really cool. But the best part, honestly, is just that I did it. It's done. It's given people, you know, X number of hours of enjoyment. And it's funny because you're so focused on trying to write a book and then get the book sold that it never occurs to you that it's an enormous request of people to ask for so many hours of their time and in right. some cases their money. And every single time someone tells me they read the book and enjoyed it, it's just the hugest honor. So, yeah, the fancy stuff, not the best part at all.
That's great. Okay, that's perfect. All right, I want to say again, the name of the book is Followers, a novel by Megan Angelo, and it's published by Graydon House. Megan, thank you so much for speaking with me. I've really enjoyed it.
Thank you, Shayla. I did too.
From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV-LP Burlington. Streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. That was an interview with the author Megan Angelo, and you can learn more about her work at meganangelo.com. This week's Write the Book prompt was generously suggested by my guest, Megan. She thought of it in response to a feeling of sadness around the lack of spontaneity in her life at a certain point in time. And so it has, in time, become an amazing writing tool for her. She says, go somewhere today, like the pharmacy or the DMV or a diner that does not play loud music. Do not look at your phone the entire time. And either see what kind of conversation you might get into with someone else who isn't buried in a phone, or eavesdrop on a conversation between other people. If you absolutely have to take notes because the conversation gets away from you, then you may, but don't use your phone for anything else other than note-taking while you conduct this exercise. Megan says that this has paid off enormous dividends whenever she has done it. So, good luck with your work in the coming week, and tune in next week for another prompt or suggestion. I would love your feedback about the show. Let me know if you'd like me to interview certain authors or if you have events to announce. Be sure to tell your friends about Write the Book and about the podcast site, writethebook.podbean.com. We're also on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and lots of other podcast sites. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates, and you can also access the podcast on my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. If you like the show, please rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and talk about it. I'm going to put on a little bit of music for the last few minutes of the hour, and then at 5 o'clock you want to stay tuned because Callie Jarvis is bringing you Feminist Frenzy. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont. Stream online at 99.3wbtv.org. Have a great week.